land is your land. This land is my land. From California, well, to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulfstream waters. I tell you, this land was made for you.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh.
getting worse. Definitely. It's obvious. You see displacement, people not finding places to stay. People got displaced from the south, from Daya, from Becca Valley, and even from areas of our fellow Christians. They as well got displaced.
Lebanon is in a state of crisis as Israel intensifies its war. Video has emerged of Israel blowing up an entire village. Meanwhile, the death toll from an Israeli attack on a municipal building has risen to at least 16, including the town's mayor. We'll go to Beirut for the latest. Then, as aid groups warn Israel is wiping northern Gaza off the map, the Biden administration is threatening to cut military assistance to Israel, but not for at least 30 days.
Given you are already saying humanitarian assistance is very low and putting in front of Israel a bunch of concrete measures on how to improve it, why are you waiting for another 30 days to implement the law?
Because we believe it's appropriate to give them a chance to cure the problem.
We'll speak to former State Department official Josh Paul, who resigned in protest last year. He's just launched a lobbying organization called A New Policy. Then we'll look at Israel's threat to launch retaliatory strikes against Iran as fears grow of a broader regional war. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Israel's two-week-long siege on northern Gaza continues. Rescue workers say dozens of bodies remain buried under collapsed buildings in Jabalia, where Israeli strikes earlier today on a UN-run school sheltering displaced Palestinians killed at least 19 people, including children. Hospitals warn food and fuel is running out. Dr. Hossam Abu Safia, director of Kamal Adwan Hospital, recorded this video late last night.
The nursery is full of cases. They are critical cases in nature. This baby here was only a few hours old when his mother was targeted right after giving birth, so his mother, father, and grandmother were martyred. This baby is now alone and has an injury to his head, which led to a secondary infection, and now he is receiving the needed treatment.
At the UN Security Council Wednesday, U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas Greenfield suggested the U.S. would start to demand evidence from Israel it is not intentionally starving Palestinians.
Policy of starvation in northern Gaza would be horrific and unacceptable and would have implications under international law and U.S. law. The government of Israel has said that this is not their policy, that food and other essential supplies will not be cut off. And we will be watching to see that Israel's actions on the ground match this statement.
This comes as a new report by Politico reveals a top Biden administration official told aid groups in late August that the U.S. would not restrict arms and funding to Israel, even if Israel blocked food and other aid from entering Gaza. Lise Grand, Biden's special envoy for Middle East humanitarian issues, reportedly told the heads of over a dozen aid groups the U.S. would never, quote, hold anything back that Israel wants, unquote. Inside Gaza, Palestinians say Israel's deliberate man-made famine has been evident for months. This is Karam Safi, a displaced Palestinian in Khan Yunus, who's been working with aid groups to provide food to up to 16,000 people.
Due to the closure of the aid crossings and the permanent siege of the north and south, we were compelled to distribute these lentils and with very simple resources and capabilities so that we can serve these people. I expect a very big catastrophe, a very big catastrophe. I mean, of a special kind. Why? Because most of the adults and children will die of hunger, and the Israelis are doing this intentionally. They are carrying out the siege to kill the people one way or another, not by strikes, but by famine. The goal is to humiliate the Palestinian people.
Meanwhile, UNRWA, which has been defunded by the U.S. since January, is warning it may soon no longer be able to function.
And I will not hide the fact that we might reach a point that we won't be able anymore to operate. And if we cannot operate anymore in Gaza, it's not just UNRWA as the main provider of services, but you have also the rest of the UN system, which very much rely and depends on the platform that the agency has offered so far. So we are very near to a possible breaking point. When will it be? I don't know. but we are very near of that.
Israeli airstrikes have hit eastern Lebanon's Bekaa Valley shortly after Israeli forces warned residents it will attack the region. Before the latest warning, 25% of Lebanon was already under forced evacuation orders from Israel. Meanwhile, the UN Interim Force in Lebanon reports its peacekeepers have once again come under, quote, direct and apparently deliberate fire, unquote, in southern Lebanon. We'll go to Beirut to speak to journalist Rania Abu Zaid after headlines. Meanwhile, Syrian media reports at least two people were injured when Israel launched an airstrike on the port city of Latakia. This comes as the Pentagon announced U.S. B-2 bombers launched so-called precision strikes against five Houthi targets in Yemen. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the attacks are in response to Houthis, quote, destabilizing behavior. Houthi fighters have attacked vessels in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden since November and vowed to continue until Israel ends its assault on Gaza and Lebanon. Kamala Harris has appeared for the first time on Fox News just weeks ahead of the November election. In what was widely described as a combative interview with Bret Baier on Wednesday evening, Harris asserted her administration will break from the Biden presidency.
My presidency will not be a continuation of Joe Biden's presidency. And like every new president that comes into office, I will bring my life experiences, my professional experiences, and fresh and new ideas. I represent a new generation of leadership.
On foreign policy, Harris called Iran the greatest threat to the U.S. and touted ongoing U.S. weapons shipments to Israel. Harris also defended her hardline stance on immigration.
I do not believe in decriminalizing border crossings, and I've not done that as vice president. I will not do that as president.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has laid out a so-called victory plan in a speech to Ukraine's parliament, proposing to end Russia's war in Ukraine by late 2025. The five-point plan calls for an immediate and unconditional invitation to Ukraine to join NATO. It would also guarantee weapons sent to Ukraine by its allies could be used for attacks on Russian soil and would see Ukrainian troops replace U.S. troops in Europe after the war. Russia's foreign ministry condemned Zelensky's plan as an escalation and warned it could push Russia into direct conflict with NATO. This comes as President Biden heads to Germany today, where he'll discuss U.S. and European support for Ukraine. The Wall Street Journal recently reported the number of Ukrainians and Russians killed or wounded since Russia's invasion in early 2022 has topped 1 million people. An Italian naval vessel carrying 16 asylum seekers who were intercepted in international waters docked in Albania Wednesday, the first in a highly contested new plan by Italy to transfer refugees to Albania while their cases are being processed. Rights groups say the policy likely violates international law. This is Giorgia Linardi with the rescue organization Sea-Watch.
The Italy-Albania plan is a way to circumvent responsibilities on asylum. It's yet another attempt to militarize borders and to delegate responsibilities over the protection of people on the move to other states to make sure that the eyes of the justice system and of the civil society cannot monitor, denounce, and protect those people. It's clearly not a question of space. There is no need for Italy to go and build extremely costly detention centers in another state.
In Nigeria, at least 153 people were killed Tuesday when a fuel tanker exploded in the northern town of Majia. Another 100 people were injured. The blast occurred as people gathered around an overturned tanker to collect the spilled gasoline. It was one of the deadliest road-related accidents ever recorded in Nigeria. In Mexico, the mayor of Candelaria Losicha in Oaxaca State died after he was attacked outside his home Tuesday. Roman Ruiz Bojerquez is the second Mexican mayor to be assassinated this month. Mexico's recently inaugurated president, Claudia Sheinbaum, has vowed to tackle violent, organized crime. Community members mourned Bojerquez at his funeral Wednesday.
Today, they killed a leader who only had the aspiration to make his community shine, his town, Candelaria Losicha. On behalf of all of my colleagues, I ask for justice for his death, that it does not go unpunished.
Here in New York, a federal district judge on Wednesday sentenced Mexico's former top security official to more than 38 years in prison following his conviction last year for accepting millions of dollars in bribes from the drug cartels he'd been tasked with prosecuting. Genaro García Luna served as Mexico's Secretary of Public Security under former President Felipe Calderón, the architect of Mexico's U.S.-backed so-called war on drugs, which has led to the killing and disappearance of tens of thousands of people. García Luna also worked closely with U.S. counter-narcotics and intelligence agencies. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has denied an 11th-hour request by death row prisoner Robert Robertson to halt his planned execution today. Despite evidence his 2003 conviction for the murder of his 2-year-old daughter was based on, quote, junk science. Unless Texas Governor Greg Abbott or the U.S. Supreme Court intervene, Robertson is set to be executed at 6 p.m. this evening. The appeals court ruling came even after a bipartisan group of lawmakers requested a stay of execution, writing, quote, "We believe it would be a stain on the conscience of the state of Texas for an execution to proceed while efforts are underway to remedy deficiencies in how the law was applied to this case." Robertson's conviction was solely based on forensic testimony that cited the, quote, shaken baby syndrome hypothesis, which was popularized in the early 2000s but never scientifically validated. The Supreme Court has left in place an Environmental Protection Agency rule curbing carbon dioxide emissions by coal and gas-fired power plants. In a brief ruling handed down Wednesday, justices rejected an emergency request by states and fossil fuel industry groups to block the EPA from enforcing rules the agency says will prevent carbon pollution equivalent to the annual emissions of some 330 million gasoline-powered cars. The case now heads back to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. In California, the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Los Angeles has agreed to an $880 million settlement with 1,353 people who survived sexual abuse by priests. It's the largest settlement of its kind in the U.S., made possible by changes to California law that lifted the statute of limitations on civil cases brought by survivors of child sexual abuse. And in Puerto Rico, Congress members Nidia Velázquez and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez formally endorsed the candidates of the Puerto Rican center-left alliance, known as the Alianza, ahead of November's election. The Alianza, which brings together the Puerto Rican Independence Party and the Citizens Victory Party, has appealed to Puerto Ricans disaffected with the two main parties over corruption scandals, austerity policies, and the disastrous privatization of the electrical grid. New York Congressmember Nidia Velázquez, the first Puerto Rican woman to serve in Congress, spoke Wednesday from Puerto Rico as she endorsed Alianza and its candidate for governor, Juan Dalmau.
If political parties with different positions dare to make an alliance to fight for a change in Puerto Rico, the logical step for me is to support them. Today, in front of the sun, I welcome hope and give my endorsement to Juan Dalmau for governor of Puerto Rico, Ana Irma Rivera Lassen for commissioner in Washington, Manuel Natal for mayor of San Juan, and the rest of the candidates of the alliance.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York with Amy Goodman in Washington, D.C. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Nermeen, and welcome to all our listeners and viewers and readers around the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Lebanon. The United Nations says Israel's war on Lebanon has displaced 1.2 million people, including 400,000 Lebanese children. Earlier today, the Israeli military attacked the Bekaa region in eastern Lebanon after ordering more people to flee their homes. This comes as the death toll from Israel's attack on a municipal building in the city of Nabatea has risen to at least 16. Lebanese officials denounced the attack, which killed the city's mayor and five other city workers who were holding a meeting to discuss distributing aid in the region. Meanwhile, the UN says its peacekeeping forces in Lebanon came under, quote, direct and apparently deliberate fire from an Israeli tank on Wednesday. The tank fire damaged a UN watchtower and destroyed two cameras. In other developments, video has emerged of Israel blowing up a historic neighborhood in the Lebanese village of Mahabib. On Wednesday, U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller was questioned about the attack by Matt Lee of the Associated Press.
I want to go just to Lebanon for a second, because there was this footage that appeared, I guess, overnight of Israel blowing up an entire village in southern Lebanon. What do you make of that?
So I've seen the footage. I cannot speak to what their intent was or what they were trying to accomplish, what their targets were. I don't know what they were. Obviously, we do not want to see entire villages destroyed. We don't want to see civilian homes destroyed. We don't want to see civilian buildings destroyed. We understand that Hezbollah does operate at times from underneath civilian homes, inside civilian homes. We've seen footage that has emerged over the course of the past 2 weeks of rockets and other military weapons held in civilian homes. So Israel does have a right to go after those legitimate targets, but they need to do so in a way that protects civilian infrastructure, protects civilians.
All right, I'm not sure I understand. I cannot speak to what their intent was or what they were trying to accomplish. Isn't it pretty clear that what their intent was? Whether they had a specific target in mind or not, blowing up an entire village, that seems to be pretty self-revelatory.
I don't know what was in those buildings. I don't know what was potentially underneath those buildings. That's when I say I can't speak to what they were trying to accomplish.
That was U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller being questioned by Matt Lee of the Associated Press. Well, we go now to Beirut, where we're joined by Rania Abu-Zeid. She's a Lebanese-Australian journalist and author based in Beirut. Her new piece for The New Yorker is titled War Comes to Beirut. Rania, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you could respond to the latest news, the places and the scale of the Israeli airstrikes in Lebanon.
Well, actually, a month ago today, the war in the south became the war in Lebanon, with Israel's mass detonation of thousands of pagers across the country. And that was followed the next day with similar triggering of explosives in walkie-talkies. And it heralded an escalation that continues to this day. So Israeli attacks have been ramped up in terms of the scope of the attacks, in terms of the frequency, the geographical location, and also the targeting. You mentioned in your intro the attack yesterday on Nabatieh's municipal building. Now, Nabatieh is a provincial capital in southern Lebanon. The Israelis had earlier called on its residents to evacuate. Some were unable or unwilling to. And the local council members, some of them including the mayor, stayed behind to provide aid, bread, to distribute bread to those people, and they were killed. Just in this past week, we have seen airstrikes on homes that have been sheltering displaced people. This week there was an attack on a house in northern Lebanon, which is the opposite end of the country from the Israeli border, and it killed more than 20 people. So we are seeing a definite escalation that started a month ago and doesn't show any sign of letting up.
Hey, Rania, if you can talk about Israel saying they are only targeting Hezbollah. Talk about the map of who is getting bombed, and also talk about what Hezbollah is responsible for, not only a military wing.
Yes, no, Hezbollah is not only a military wing, it is also a political party. It has members of parliament, more than a dozen of them. It has ministers in this government and certainly in governments over many years past. It has a very vigorous and active social services arm, which includes first responders. They have also come under attack by the Israelis, and many of them have been killed. So it's a multi-armed organization, which is an integral part of Lebanon's social and political and military fabric. In terms of the victims of these Israeli strikes, I mean, I can tell you that the death tolls The daily death tolls are in the double digits, and most of those people who are killed are women and children. In that attack in northern Lebanon that I mentioned, there was an 80-year-old woman who was killed along with two babies. So it's not just going after Hezbollah. We've heard this before. We've heard this in Gaza, that they're only going after Hamas. And it's the same thing that we're hearing here. I mean, yesterday, as you mentioned also in your intro, Israeli troops rigged an entire village in southern Lebanon, which is very close to the border, and they blew it up. This is the Gaza playbook.
Are in Beirut for your latest piece for The New Yorker. You've been speaking to people who've been displaced there, tens of thousands. If you could tell us what they were saying and what the situation in Beirut is as more and more people are displaced from areas around Lebanon.
Well, first of all, the Israeli drones don't seem to leave the air. They don't seem to leave the skies over Beirut, and they're not just over the southern suburbs, which is where Hezbollah had offices and a presence. It's everywhere across the city. It is this incessant buzzing. The displaced are being housed in more than 1,000 facilities across the country, including more than 700 schools and educational facilities. There are also many people who are still on the streets. Just yesterday, I was with a group of hundreds of displaced people who are in an area very close to the coast, to the Lebanese coast, in an area called Biel. And they're staying, I can't even call them tents, because the four sides were completely open to the elements. It was just a piece of canvas overhead. And these people are displaced from all over Lebanon, not just from the south. They were displaced from the southern suburbs of Beirut, an area known as Dahiyeh, and as well as the Bekaa, which has also come under bombardment, and elsewhere. There were Syrians among them, too. So, yes, the government has opened more than 1,000 shelters, but it's not enough given the sheer volume of people who have been displaced. Many have also been taken in by Lebanese into their homes, and that is why some of these houses, we've seen some of these displaced people who were taken in by Lebanese in other parts of the country come under Israeli attack.
And Rania, if you could talk about the number of people you spoke to who consider themselves anti-Hezbollah, how are they feeling now?
Well, it's definitely the sentiment here is that this is now a war on Lebanon, and that there is no safe space. When Christian villages in the north and in the south can also be targeted, there is a sense that you just don't know who Israel is targeting. They claim that they are chasing Hezbollah operatives. Who knows? There are question marks about that. Is there any proof of that? Like yesterday, when they blew up the village in the south, they said that there were Hezbollah tunnels under this. They seem, again, this is part of the Gaza playbook. They can say that there is a command center, Hamas command center, under one of the hospitals, and blow it up. So there is a sense that there are certainly Lebanese who disagree with Hezbollah's decision to open what it called a support front to ease the pressure off Gaza. That was how Hezbollah described its support front. There are Lebanese who disagree with that. There are Lebanese who blame Hezbollah for dragging the country into the war. And there are many others who see Hezbollah as the frontline defense against Israeli not only airstrikes and attacks, but also there have been attempts over the past 2.5 weeks or so for Israeli ground troops to enter southern Lebanon, and they have faced very fierce resistance from Hezbollah fighters in the south.
Well, if you could respond, Rania, to what Netanyahu has said about Israel's intentions in Lebanon. He said that the Lebanese basically need to eliminate Hezbollah unless people of Lebanon, he says, quote, take the country back and free themselves from Hezbollah. Lebanon would be turned into Gaza. I mean, your response, people are saying, suggesting that what he wants, what Israel really wants, is to instigate a civil war in Lebanon. Is that the general sentiment?
That is the general sentiment, and that is the sentiment that was conveyed from some of the country's top politicians down to some of these displaced people who are still on the streets of Beirut. That is that's how it was interpreted, that he's basically saying, turn on each other, or we will turn you into Gaza. And we see these efforts to try and foment this suspicion among Lebanese. There are in all of those cases that I mentioned, when displaced people who were taken into homes in other parts, let me be frank, in non-Shiite areas of Lebanon, were targeted by the Israelis. There is this sense that the Israelis are trying to make Lebanese fear each other, to try and make the people of the South almost outcasts, and to make people afraid to take in the displaced into their homes and into their communities. This is compounded by the fact that in recent days, Israeli journalists just casually tweet something saying, hey, you know, what's happening in a garden in a particular neighborhood? And that causes widespread panic when the Lebanese fear that perhaps that garden, they're saying that because that garden or that facility might be targeted. Just before we went on air, there was a report that the Al Jazeera offices in central Beirut have also received a similar warning and that they have now been evacuated. So there is this panic and this sense that Israel can target whatever it wants, whenever it wants, and that they're with complete impunity.
Your response also to Prime Minister Netanyahu, Rania, saying that he's demanding UNIFIL soldiers get out of combat zones, alleging their presence is providing a human shield for Hezbollah. And overall, talk about the significance of saying that the peacekeepers—I think there are about 10,000 of them in southern Lebanon—should get out of the way. Many saying they want them—that Israel wants them out because they don't want international observers describing what's happening there. But how UNIFIL is seen in Lebanon?
Well, I'll tell you how UNIFIL has responded to those threats. And UNIFIL has said that they're not going anywhere. UNIFIL is the peacekeeping force that is stationed along the UN-delineated blue line, which is the border between the two states. It is their role to stay there and to monitor what is happening there. We've seen five attacks now, direct Israeli attacks on UNIFIL bases. They have wounded peacekeepers. They have taken out surveillance cameras on some of these bases. They've also, on one occasion, actually used a bulldozer to try and bring down a wall on one of these UNIFIL bases. So it's all part of this effort to sort of intimidate and to attempt to discredit not just UNIFIL, but the UN. We've seen the same thing with UNRWA, which is the UN agency which is tasked with dealing with Palestinian refugees. Beyond that, I mean, we saw Netanyahu himself at the UN General Assembly stand on the podium there and call the UN anti-Semitic. Israel has declared the UN Secretary General persona non grata in Israel. So it's all part of this coordinated effort to try and discredit the UN if it points out things like international law and the laws of war and international humanitarian law and, in fact, UNIFIL's mission and why it is in southern Lebanon.
Rania, could you explain, this idea, this doctrine, the Dahiyeh doctrine, and whether, which is named, of course, after the area outside Beirut, which has come under a fire from Israel, and whether you think that's actually in effect now? And I just want to just quote a brief passage from your New Yorker piece where you point out, I mean, just to give a scale, a sense of the scale of Israel's assault, a number of health workers have been killed, health facilities targeted. You quote Air Wars, a British conflict monitor, who told the Washington Post that Israel's offensive in Lebanon was, quote, the most intense aerial campaign that we know of in the last 20 years, of course, with the exception of Gaza. So if you could explain the Dahiyeh doctrine and your sense of whether it's in effect now.
Well, the Dahiyeh doctrine was created basically after the 2006 war. And to put it very bluntly, the idea is that you cause so much pain to a community that you try and pry public support from the non-state actor, in this case Hezbollah. So the idea is that you inflict so much pain on Hezbollah's support base, on what is known here as the resistance community, that it turns against the group. And this is why we're seeing, the scope of the targets is so wide. It is not just you know, Israelis are not just targeting Hezbollah infrastructure, military targets. They're also targeting, as I said, people, displaced people who have escaped to parts of the country that are very far away from the border. They're targeting, the Lebanon's public health minister has said that he, you know, there are hospitals that have been bombed and closed their doors because of the threat of Israeli strikes. More than 100 paramedics have been killed. Medical centers have been targeted. So it is a very the targeting is very broad, and the idea is to try and, as I said, pry that support to say actually Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem said this not in his last speech, which was a few days ago, but in the one before that. He said this is the war about who screams first. So it's about inflicting pain on the other side and who is going to say enough first. And the Dahi Doctrine thinks that if you inflict enough pain on Hezbollah's supporters, you will pry them away from the party.
Rani Abu Zaid is a Lebanese-Australian journalist and author based in Beirut. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll link to your piece for The New Yorker, War Comes to Beirut. Coming up, as aid groups warn Israel is wiping northern Gaza off the map, the Biden administration is threatening to cut military assistance to Israel in 30 days if more aid is not allowed into the area. We'll speak to former State Department official Josh Paul, who resigned in protest last year. Back in a minute.
Last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, all on board, last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, all on board. Rifle, who gave the order? Who planned the campaign to lay waste the land? Who manufactured the bullet? Who paid the taxes? Tell me, is this blood upon my hand? Last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, all on board, last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg. Last train to Nuremberg, one bar.
Last Train to Nuremberg by Pete Seeger. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York with Amy Goodman in Washington, D.C. Northern Gaza is being wiped off the map. That's the warning from Oxfam and 35 other humanitarian groups who say Israel's siege on northern Gaza has reached a, quote, horrifying level of atrocity. Earlier today, Israel's military bombed an UNRWA school in Jabalia, housing hundreds of displaced Palestinian families. Al Jazeera reports the death toll from the attack has climbed to 25, with many children among the dead. As Israel continues its siege on northern Gaza, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin sent Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a letter Sunday threatening to cut off U.S. military assistance if Israel does not boost humanitarian aid access to Gaza within the next 30 days. The Biden administration has continued to arm Israel despite findings by its own experts at USAID and the State Department that Israel has routinely impeded delivery of food and medicine to Gaza in violation of U.S. law. Politico has revealed that in August, Biden's special envoy for Middle East humanitarian issues, Lise Grand, met with leaders of more than a dozen aid organizations and directly said the U.S. would not suspend arms to Israel. One person who attended the meeting told Politico, quote, she was saying that the rules don't apply to Israel. Grant also reportedly said the United States will not, quote, hold anything back that they want. We're joined now by Josh Paul. He's a former veteran State Department official who resigned in protest of the push to increase arms sales to Israel amid its assault on Gaza. He's a former director in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs in the State Department. On Wednesday, he and Tariq Habash, who resigned in protest from the Education Department, announced the formation of a new lobbying organization and a political action committee called A New Policy to push for Washington to take a new approach on Israel-Palestine. Josh Paul, welcome back to Democracy Now! We'll talk about this new organization and the PAC that you've formed. But first, if you could respond to the letter that Austin and Blinken sent to Netanyahu, what it said and what it means that they gave Israel 30 days. Of course, in 30 days, that's after the U.S. elections will take place and a new administration will be in power.
Yes, thank you, Amy, and good to join you this morning. So I want to clarify to begin with that the letter that that Blinken and Austin sent to their counterparts in the Israeli government didn't actually threaten to cut off arms or to suspend security assistance. It simply said that there could be consequences under National Security Memorandum 20 and under U.S. law. What those consequences are, I think, remains to be seen, if at all. We have seen repeated expressions of concern from the United States government over the course of the last year. And yet what this letter makes clear in its detail, and it is a detailed letter, it lists, I believe, 15 steps the United States would like to see Israel take to facilitate the entry of humanitarian assistance into Gaza. What it does by doing so is demonstrate that the U.S. is currently in breach of its own laws. U.S. law says the U.S. cannot provide security or any form of assistance to a country that is restricting the delivery of U.S.-funded humanitarian assistance. Here we have, in writing from this administration, a list of the ways in which Israel is doing so, and yet U.S. military assistance continues to flow. And, of course, nowhere in the law does it say, you know, give them 30 days to see if they can fix it. The law is very clear that when it is made known to the president that assistance is being restricted, U.S. assistance cannot be provided. So I think that there is, you know, plenty of reasons for skepticism here. And, of course, while people are starving on a daily basis in Gaza, dying of malnutrition, the time for this to be fixed is now. The time for it to be fixed was actually almost a year ago, but it is certainly now, not in 30 days.
So, Josh Paul, if you can talk, although you left the State Department protesting U.S. policy on Israel, and you were the person who approved weapons sales within the State Department, you clearly still have contacts within the State Department. Can you talk about what people are saying? I mean, everything from the revelations of ProPublica, also as speaking to other people who quit over reports coming out of the State Department saying clearly Israel is cutting off, preventing humanitarian aid from coming in, and yet Blinken turns these reports around. What people are saying? Are there more resignations within the State Department? And what the U.S. accomplishes, since Netanyahu is such a clear ally of Trump and wants him to win, yet Biden still embraces him, supports him, and even with this warning letter, as you said, you know, the election will happen by the time they were to cut off aid if Israel doesn't comply with what U.S. is demanding.
Yes, that last part in particular has been a bit of a mystery to me and I think lots of other people, because it has been very clear that Prime Minister Netanyahu has long had a preference for the Republican Party and for President Trump. He made that clear again when he came to Washington. He has made that clear in running rings around President Biden repeatedly over the course of the last year. So what the thinking there is on the part of Democratic strategists, I just can't fathom. You know, with regard to how things are playing out within the State Department, it's actually been a year to the day since I handed in my resignation at the State Department. And, you know, there was a significant increase in dissent, in protest within the department in the initial months of this conflict. I think the challenge is that none of that really led to any policy because what we, or policy changes, because what we have is a very tightly controlled set of decisions that are being made on a very political and politicized basis from the very top levels of the U.S. government. You noted that, you know, within the State Department, there has been increasing transparency and pushes from USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and from, for example, the Bureau of Population, Refugees and Migration, to submit to Secretary Blinken evidence that Israel is restricting U.S.-funded humanitarian assistance. I think it is worth noting that when ProPublica's piece came out 2 weeks ago, reporting that these reports had gone to Secretary Blinken and he had cast them aside. That report also noted that one of those officials, Julieta Valletta Noyes, Assistant Secretary for Population, Refugees and Migration, had been asked to, if she felt that Section 620I of the law that says we cannot provide assistance in these circumstances had been triggered. Her initial response was yes. When she was pressed, she backed down. I think it's worth noting that she quietly resigned a week ago, shortly after the ProPublica story came out. So I think there is a degree still of concern and certainly of shame amongst higher-level officials. I know that amongst lower-level officials, there is immense pain. I've heard from people in the last week saying they don't know if they can do this any longer. At the same time, I think there's also a feeling of desperation and that there's really nothing under President Biden that can be done or can be changed from the inside on this issue. So people are waiting to see what happens next and what happens after the election.
And do you see, from your vantage point as an insider, any space between Biden and Harris?
I think that's very hard to say. Certainly, Vice President Harris, as a candidate, has not given us much evidence that there is any space. On the contrary, she has said repeatedly that she will continue the policies set by President Biden, including of unconditional support for Israel. There are people around Vice President Harris. Her policy team are, I think, different than those around Biden. And I think as well that Harris is not the ideologue on this issue that President Biden is. But I do think that what we face here is a deep-rooted and very entrenched set of political economic incentives that will make it very hard for anyone to change U.S. policy in this regard, regardless of the outcome of the election or of this election. This is something that is going to take a long time to resolve and a lot of effort. And to get to the point that you opened our session with, that's why Tariq Habash and I and a group of extraordinary, remarkable leaders, including former U.S. Ambassador to Syria Robert Ford, have created a new policy. This is a lobbying organization and a political action committee founded on the idea that what we face here is actually not a policy problem. We know what the policy problems are. The people in government know what the policy problems are. What we face here is a political problem. And until we fix the politics, until we play within this ugly system that we have to make it work in the interests of the American voters, the American people, American values, and the interests of all of the people in the region, we are not going to make headway. So that is what we are out to do.
And Josh Paul, if you could also respond to recent reports that suggest that Israel will launch retaliatory strikes against Iran within the next 3 weeks, that is to say before the U.S. election. And although the Biden administration has reportedly won assurances from Israel that they will not attack Iranian nuclear or oil sites, of course, the implications of this would be enormous. If you could respond to that and how you think the Biden administration would respond in the event that Israel does attack Iran.
Well, so let's first of all remember that the Biden administration also won assurances from Israel back in April that it would conduct itself in accordance with international humanitarian law and not restrict the flow of humanitarian assistance in Gaza. So I'm not sure how much assurances from Israel at this point are worth or how credibly they can be taken. That said, I think that one of the things that is empowering Prime Minister Netanyahu in this situation is his knowledge that America has Israel's back, that no matter what Israel does, you know, we have deployed now a terminal high-altitude air defense system, a THAAD system, which is our most capable and most expensive air defense system to Israel. We have deployed several squadrons of U.S. fighter jets. We have deployed U.S. Navy ships. And I think that the problem there is that we create for Prime Minister Netanyahu this ability to escalate without concern of the repercussions and, indeed, if anything, a certain attraction one can imagine to him of getting America involved in a conflict with Iran that he has long craved. So I think these are, indeed, very dangerous times, particularly as we lead into a U.S. election here.
Finally, Josh, a new policy, the name of your new organization, a new policy's website says the United States policy in the Middle East should comply with American laws, reflect American values, advance peace, and peace and prosperity for all Americans. Are you saying now that the U.S. is breaking U.S. law?
So not only am I saying that the U.S. is breaking U.S. law, but I've actually heard, as have others, who I'm working with from members of Congress behind closed doors who will say, we believe that what Israel is doing with our weapons amounts to war crimes, but we won't say that publicly. what a new policy's mission ultimately is, as Tariq Abbas said today in the magazine Semaphore, is to change that, is to fix that, is to make it so that U.S. elected officials can vote in accordance with their voters' preferences, with their constituents' interests, with American interests, with American values, and with American law. We need to remove these structural roadblocks and these financial, frankly, roadblocks to our democracy and to the enforcement of our law. So if all of your listeners or viewers would like to visit, we're at www.anewpolicy.org and happy to continue the conversation there as well.
Thanks so much, Josh Paul, former director in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs in the State Department. He resigned in protest last year. He's just launched a lobbying group called A New Policy. Thanks so much for joining us. Coming up, we'll look at Israel's threats to launch retaliatory strikes against Iran as fears grow of a broader regional war. Say It Over and Over Again by John Coltrane Quartet. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York with Amy Goodman in Washington, D.C. We end today's show looking at the rising risk of a broader regional war in the Middle East. The Pentagon has announced U.S. B-2 bombers attacked five Houthi targets in Yemen earlier today. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the attacks came in response to Houthis, quote, destabilizing behavior. Houthi fighters have attacked vessels in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden since November and vowed to continue until Israel ends its assault on Gaza and Lebanon. This comes as the Biden administration is deploying an advanced anti-missile defense system and 100 U.S. troops to Israel as Israel threatens to carry out retaliatory strikes against Iran in response to Iran's recent ballistic missile attack on Israeli military and security sites. Earlier today, the commander of Iran's elite Revolutionary Guards issued a new warning to Israel. The commander, Hossein Salami, was speaking at the funeral of Brigadier General Abbas Nilforoshan, who was killed in the Israeli attack that killed Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah.
You, Israel, may imagine that THAADs can compensate for your shortcomings in defending you. This is a mistake. Do not trust the tubes of these launchers. You cannot massacre Muslim nations, but remain safe, secure, and live in peace. No, that cannot happen.
We're joined now by Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's the author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Trita. If you could just begin by responding to this latest news.
So I think it's extremely important for the American public to understand that what Biden has done here is that he has deployed U.S. troops into an active war zone in another country's war. There are no direct and clear U.S. interests at stake here. And the Biden administration is essentially presenting this as if it is defending Israel or helping Israel defend itself, whereas in reality, these are the distinction between defensive and offensive weapons here is rather irrelevant, because what the Biden administration is doing is reducing the cost for Israel to escalate tensions in the region. Every time Biden does this, it makes it easier for Israel to escalate. And as a result, it has continues to do exactly that. If Biden was not reducing the cost of escalation, it would have been costlier for Israel to do the steady escalation as we've seen in the last year, widening of the war. And it would have thought twice. Perhaps the cost would even have been prohibited. So if the Biden administration's actual goal is to prevent the widening of the war, prevent escalation in the region, adding defensive or any type of military capabilities to the side that actually is leading the escalation is not something that in any way, shape, or form actually can help calm the situation down. Instead, it actually helps fuel tensions in the region and increases the likelihood of the very same widening of the war that Biden claims that he is against.
Can you give us, Trita, a chronology of what happened, the bombing on the inauguration of the new president by Israel of Tehran? Not clear if it was an airstrike, if it was a bomb that was planted that killed the Hamas negotiator, Ismail Haniyeh. Then that was Israel. Iran waits weeks and then attacks with 180 anti-ballistic missiles that kill no one but a Palestinian who died from, not clear, the shrapnel that came down from the sky in Jericho. They said they were just targeting military sites in Israel. Is Iran coordinating, by the way, with the United States, actually, in all of this? Is there more behind-the-scenes communication than we understand?
There is behind-the-scenes communication, undoubtedly. And there is, perhaps at a surfical level, a degree of coordination. I think the Iranians do not want to see escalation, knowing very well that they are in a weaker military position. And they know quite well that Netanyahu has been looking, itching for a war for quite some time, a war that he designs to drag the U.S. into it. And his best opportunity to drag the U.S. into this unnecessary war is in the next 3 weeks. So the Iranians have been rather restrained, hoping that they would avoid walking into Israel's trap. This is part of the reason why, after the assassination of Haniyeh, despite the fact that they promised a response, they didn't respond. They claimed that there were promises from the U.S. and Europe that there would be a ceasefire and that they waited to give that a chance. No ceasefire came. But on top of that, instead, Israel attacks Lebanon, kills Nasrallah, as well as the senior IRGC official. And after that, the Iranians decide to respond, and they do so by striking military targets. And in that strike, they also demonstrate their capacity to penetrate Israel's air defenses, which is precisely why when the THAAD is now being deployed over there in Israel, is an admission that the Israeli air defenses are insufficient. This, again, goes back to what I said earlier on. Every time Israel escalates the war, Biden rushes in to protect Israel from the consequences of its own escalation. That is not a strategy to prevent escalation. That is a strategy that fuels escalation.
So, Trita, could we also talk about what role countries in the region could potentially play in any possible retaliation against Iran? The Iranian foreign minister was recently in Riyadh. He's now in Egypt. But people have spoken specifically about Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Israel has been trying to persuade them to, quote, not facilitate any possible Israeli retaliation. If you could talk about the relationship between the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, the various sites at which they've been at odds, and where they stand at the moment vis-a-vis Iran.
There's been an interesting evolution of the position of the Saudis and the Emiratis. 15 years ago, they were not publicly, but privately, they were lobbying the U.S. quite aggressively to go to war with Iran. This was revealed by the WikiLeaks, in which the cables showed how much very senior officials, including the king of Saudi Arabia at the time, was pushing for the U.S. to go to war. This has now changed in the last couple of years. There's both been a bit of a rapprochement between these countries, but also a clear realization on the Saudi and the Emirati side that the Iranians actually have capabilities that go far beyond what they had expected, which means that in case of a war, the Iranians would have the capacity of destroying a tremendous amount of facilities in Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. And as a result, those two countries would suffer tremendously in the case of a war, which is something that they previously did not think was the case. Today, I don't think they are in any way, shape, or form eager for this type of a confrontation. And I think the message from the Iranian side to them has been that if they facilitate, if they allow their airspace to be used or their bases to be used for an attack against Iran, the Iranians will also retaliate against them directly. I think that message from the Iranians is sent to them in order for them to put pressure on the Biden administration to actually restrain Israel, something that the Biden administration has been unwilling to do. The Iranians don't have a direct way of pressuring the Biden administration, but they appear to be calculating that through Saudi Arabia and the UAE, there may be a greater likelihood that the Biden administration finally will do something to prevent the Israelis from further escalation.
Trita Parsi, according to the Washington Post, Israel's now considering striking military sites in Iran, but not Iran's oil or nuclear facilities. However, many in the U.S. and Israel are saying, take this moment to strike, take out Iran's nuclear facilities. We know, of course, Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal that Obama had negotiated. What exactly would this mean, what is about to take place, apparently?
Most military analysis point to the fact that the Israelis actually don't have the capacity of delivering a fatal blow to Iran's nuclear facilities. They have been pushing for a larger attack, including against oil installations and economic infrastructure. The Biden administration has pushed back and has essentially delivered a list of military targets that they believe would be adequate for Israel's response. The Israelis reportedly have agreed to this, but I think it's very important to understand that most of this is frankly meaningless. Because once the Israelis strike, particularly if they strike against military sites and try to target military officials, as they have done in Lebanon, there will be civilian casualties. There will be an escalation that will almost make it inevitable for the Iranians to then respond again, which then means that in the second iteration of this, the Israelis are very likely to go after economic infrastructure, oil installations, and potentially the nuclear program as well. As long as we are on an escalatory cycle, it does not matter what the first step is. What matters is what the last step is. And as long as we are on that cycle and Biden is not preventing it, it's frankly meaningless if the first step is to avoid targeting nuclear sites and economic infrastructure. This will escalate towards a war in which all of those different things will be targeted, both on the Iranian side as well as on the Israeli side.
And Trita, finally, if you could talk about, respond to the fact that Netanyahu, much like we spoke about this in our earlier segment on Lebanon, much like as he did with Lebanon, gave a direct address to the Lebanese people, he did the same with Iran last month, saying with every passing moment, the Iranian government is bringing the noble Persian people closer to the abyss. What is the significance of this, and why is he doing that?
Well, he's done this on previous occasions as well, not only in the context of Gaza and Lebanon, but in the case of Iran as well. I think the primary target of this is actually not the Iranian public. The message was in English, and the original video had English subtitles. This is a message to the Western audience in order to present Israel's war of aggression as a defensive war, as a war that will help get rid of a very unpopular regime in Iran. And as a result, just as with the Iraq war, this deserves the support of the Western publics because the government in Iran is so problematic, similar to the argument against Saddam Hussein. And remember, it was Netanyahu who testified in Congress back right before the Iraq war, promising that an attack on Iraq would have positive reverberations throughout the entire region.
Thank you, Trita Parsi. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and The Triumph of Diplomacy. And that does it for our show. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman for another edition of Democracy Now!
WRCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
Yep, it's time for Whiskey Before Breakfast. I am Mando Richard. Thank you so much for tuning in. And as usual, we'll begin on the liquored up side of the family. And we'll close with some tracks from the gospel side of the family. And in between, we've got lots of good stuff, including, of course, a set of what I consider folk rock music. All right, let's get things started. Here's something from the band Yarn. I don't think they ever really figured out whether they were rock or country or whatever. But here it is, the song Liquor Love.
I don't know about you, but I could use a drink. Is there something you do? Don't partake. Got some drinking to do. I don't know about you, but it's the best I ever had. Going down so smooth, it ain't stinging so bad. Done some drinking, you see. Liquor love.